Day morning on Bri Radio. And here's politics teachers question time. Hi there, good morning everyone, and for the final time in this iteration, Politics Teachers Question Time, I think I'm going to be here next year, as usual. I'm like a sort of fossil buried beneath the surface of Bri Anston School, but these two guys ain't going to be here. So for the final time, Bridges, morning Bridges, giving a big yawn. How are you doing, mate?
Yeah, feeling good, feeling sad, but feeling good.
And Smitty, how are we doing?
Yeah, same. Last politics teaching section today. Both of us.
Today, last today, we're both teaching the last politics lesson.
And it sounds like Mr. Smith's got to teach a C class on rural electrification.
No, I'm kidding. I just actually said that as a vocal stand.
Them's hard yards on a hot day in a hot classroom.
The kids on that would be a rough note after the alphabet agencies.
I'm afraid I did that yesterday. Sorry, C3.
Did you apologise after the last
I did, yeah. I had to apologise on Monday because my lesson was so boring. But there we go. That happens quite often. Right, so we got a special sort of last Politics Teachers Question Time. We'll have a change of personnel next year, which will be interesting. But, yeah, we are recording.
Sure. I was like, this is a big one.
Yeah, it has been known in the past. Where are we going today, Bridges?
Where to start? We spoke last week, didn't we, about Keir Starmer? Let's not talk about him too much. But oh my goodness, how do you lose your authority as quickly as that when you've got a 165 seat majority? Absolute embarrassment from the government. The way they've played this welfare bill has been absolutely atrocious. And instead of staring down the rebels with the 165 seat majority, and if necessary, using the Conservatives to get the vote over the line, they've buckled. And as I was saying to Mr. Vincent yesterday, what this says about the state of the government is interesting, because if you're a government in year four fighting for survival in the build-up to an election, you might yield on something like this to get this legislation over the line. But if you are a government that is less than 18 months in and you're already making concessions to such an extent and facing the rebellion of such an extent...
12 months, isn't it? Is this...
Yeah. It's not even 18 months. 18 months sort of the standard for when governments tend to start falling apart. When you look at the coalition and others, 18 months is sort of the end of the honeymoon period. It's well and truly over for Keir Starmer. And, you know, one of either Starmer or Reeves is going to pay the price for this in the medium term. And I suspect it will probably be Reeves, but I'm not sure whether Starmer will be far behind. And it's really, really interesting that for Labour, they're in the position that they're in just a year on. And I think it's reflective of this coalition that's just so shallow. And I think, you've said it lots of times, Simon, but the coalition is shallow for Labour. It's very, very wide. It's got lots of different people in it, but it isn't very deep at all. And there's a lot of people with lots of different perspectives of how the Labour Party should run in the Labour Party. And when you've got such a big majority that's built on such a shallow coalition, you're going to have significant groups of people that don't agree with the centre, where Starmer naturally sits. And
it's interesting to what, I mean, we slightly mentioned this last time, whether that is just modern politics.
Yeah.
Whether that loyalty, I mean, the silver lining for the Labour Party is there is literally nothing waiting on the taxi rank. Right, there is no coherence from the Conservatives at all. There's a lot of noise from Reform, but they're years away from being able to actually challenged. I mean, they couldn't be a shadow government right now. They've got five MPs.
Yeah.
Lib Dems are probably the most coherent opposition the government's got, and that's not saying a huge amount.
No.
So we're in a, you know, if we had a coherent and well-led Conservative Party, this would be properly worrying for Labour. It's worrying anyway, because it's an absolute shambles. I think what we're seeing, and, you know, not that I'm trying to make analogies, we've seen a replacement at the top of the Labour Party to try and bring it back to be more electable. There's lots of kind of bright-eyed young things. There's lots of children of former politicians. They're all cut from a certain kind of cloth. and they're not listening to the people on the ground. It's this kind of new cabal have come in. They think they've got all the ideas, that everything else is passé. And it was George W. Bush who said lots of silly things in his life, didn't he? But when he left power, he said, I've realised that politics isn't about policies, it's about relationships. And actually what they haven't done is build those relationships, the people who've been in their constituencies for years, who know them, who know their constituents. They've come in and taken on this kind of nouveau technocratic invention. And they've tried to run with it and basically la 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 la, not listening. And they've come a cropper with it. But it would be interesting to see if there was a coherent Conservative Party, whether Labour MPs would have rebelled in the same way.
Yeah.
I suspect that partly this rebellion is born out of the utterly sort of armchair position that they find themselves in.
And Labour probably, and the Conservatives did a similar thing in the early part of Boris's premiership. But what it makes less likely is other U-turns on, and we've spoken about, for example, the inheritance tax for farmers. That's very unlikely now to happen because they can't backslide on that as well, because by backsliding on this welfare bill, they've got £6 billion they've got to find. And this is the bottom line. The government's fiscal headroom was $9 billion. That was the surplus that they had to play with after all of these economic reforms. Now it's effectively going to be $3 billion. Where does it come? Where? How do we pay for this $6 billion? Probably going to have to be tax rises, which I said is not going to happen. So the consequence of this victory for the rebels in the party, is that the Chancellor in particular was in a very, very uncomfortable position, because her effective main, her, you know, big ticket policy on welfare reform has been shot through the bowels and sunk before it even got out of the port. So it's interesting. It's really interesting now to see what Starmer does. Is it time for a reshuffle? That, you know, he said about the summer was a reset anyway. That doesn't seem to have been very effective, and you know, it's up to him what he does now, but I can't imagine he can keep hold of the Chancellor, because he's going to have to pivot into a different direction.
Yeah, I think trying to ride these two horses at the same time is showing its shortcomings. I mean, the fact is, actually, if we reflect on the last 12 months, and it is almost to a day, to about a week, isn't it? It's 12 months. Actually, in terms of foreign policy, this government's been pretty effective. In fact, maybe even more than effective. I think that what Starmer has done is re-establish the UK on the world scene in a way that is quite impressive. But in doing so, and this is always the problem, isn't it, in politics, he's taken his eye off the domestic side of things, and he's spent lots of time at summits and whatever, and not listening to the grassroots. And I think in this era of politics, where people are much less deferential, where people are much less prepared to take authority centrally, and again, it's not just the Labour thing. You know, look at the number of resignations that led to Boris's fall. Look at the way that resignations led to Liz Truss's fall. Look at the way that non-compliance in the Conservative Party led to Rishi Sunak's fall. I mean, actually, all governments, it just usually takes a little bit longer. So I think what we're seeing here is kind of similar to some other governments, just slightly on steroids, because the public's attention, TikTok generation, you guys, come on, doesn't really alight on anything for one period of time. And the person who's the master at exploiting this, and maybe we don't want to go there yet, is your man, DJT, right?
Yes.
Like, distract, dissemble. Yeah. Look, here we go. Oh, look, there's a squirrel. Let's go after that.
It's like fighting smoke, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Nailing down smoke.
Blame it on your predecessor. Blame it on something that's happening outside of our borders. Blame it on immigration. And he can... And we'll talk about the One Big Beautiful Bill, but we're both seeing, you know, a bit of pushback to legislation in both the UK and the US with obviously a slimmer majority in the U.S.'s House and Senate, but Trump is still able to weaponize his Republican cronies now in both the House and Senate to get this bill done. And people don't know, Republican voters in these rural states don't know that it's going to be affecting them directly, because he is
20 million people lose their health care?
That might be, 17 is the number I've been hearing. 8 is what I've heard from other sources. I mean, in the millions, at the very least.
And people are going to die.
People are going to die.
And so that it's gonna billionaires be the, can get tax cuts.
It's going to be the Republican states. I mean, yeah. You talk about rural hospitals. It's you're leaning more so Republican states than you are, you know, a California or New York or Illinois. They don't read the 948 pages. They don't read the BBC telling you what's in the bill. And he's able to prey on that. And he's been able to use his majority, and they got Lisa Murkowski to get that vote to 50, and J.D. Vance is the tiebreaker in the Senate, and then it's done. They just need to get to 50.
They got to go back to the House now.
Yeah, so they can afford to. I think they can afford to lose 3 defectors. But if they so much as make an edit, I think it's killed.
But it's not going to happen, is it?
No, it seems like it's a done deal. It's a very small chance of it not passing.
What's really interesting is what the bipartisan pressure on the public land sell-off was very effective.
Yeah.
That was cross-party. It was from all states, and they effectively achieved what they wanted to because Mike Lee, the senator, pulled that from the bill. So it's sort of evidence of what can be achieved when there is bipartisan support for things. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's a pretty significant thing for all of Americans, because think about land ownership in America. It's much more communist than in the United Kingdom. Yeah. The UK, there isn't a vast proportion of the land that's set aside for public good, where anyone can fish, anyone can hunt, anyone can camp, anyone can walk, you can do what you want on that land. It's very rare. So it's a thing of, you know, given the capitalistic nature of the United States, it's a very, very special thing.
Yeah.
So the fact that there was bipartisan support for that to get pulled is very important and very interesting, and shows how the system can work. But it doesn't seem to be that there's that consensus on the other things in the bill, because that's quite an easy thing to rally behind if you're a Democrat, and if you're a rural Republican, you just say, no, that's not happening, sorry. And it's very easy for them to stand next to a Democrat and say the same thing.
But it's unfortunately the most stratified issues that are now the focal point of this bill.
So how is it that you get something like the land sell-off that isn't really magnified, but basically everything else is, which makes it very difficult for Republicans to stand next to Democrats on? And why is it the case that a Republican can effectively vote for that bill and look at that and say that the funding to cuts in hospitals in rural America is going to be effectively smashed? I mean, it's really interesting, but also at the same time, mad. And also, the numbers 50-50 in the Senate. I mean, some Republicans voted against this, right?
Yeah.
Rand Paul. Tom Tillis.
I think Tillis is probably going to retire.
He's announced he's going to retire.
Yeah, it's like taking its toll on these guys. Who else? And then Murkowski probably would have voted against it, but must have been pressured out the wazoo to get to that tie-breaking vote. So I saw a thing from Chris Murphy, who's a Democratic senator from Connecticut, and he was just saying, how do these Republican senators and what will be Republican congressmen and women go back to their constituencies and justify this bill? If you're in Wyoming, if you're in Nebraska, and you're in one of these rural states, and you look at the bill's provisions and say that somehow you were fighting for your constituencies, the non-Warren Buffetts of Nebraska, you've got nothing on there. And maybe that money's going to border security. But if you're in Wyoming, you know, you still need immigrants for the service industry there in Jackson and... Sorry, I'm getting into the weeds, but there's nothing that I can actually trace in that bill that will help these constituents.
No. There's lots that will help. But I mean, this is where we reach the kind of apogee, isn't it, of imperial corruption. That what Trump has done already, and let's remember, what are we, 3 months in? 4 months in?
Yeah.
4 months in.
Yeah,
four and a bit months in. The enrichment of the Trump Family Inc. as a result of this premiership. He was on Truth Social the other day pushing his new perfume.
Who's got a perfume?
Trump.
What's it smell like?
It's called...
Success.
It's called Victory 4547, The Smell of Power or something.
Nice.
Okay, which he's pushing using his position. But the thing is, the Supreme Court has said that what he does now in power is legal. And now he is president, rather than wanting to be president, he now has the power of presidential pardon for all these people. So if you literally don't give a monkey's what happens in 2028, because you and your family will be all right, what is there to restrain? Does he care if the Republican Party go down in flames? No. Okay, I don't think people say he talks about running for a third term, which of course constitutionally can't. I don't think he either wants to or has plans to. But
I think that too. I don't think he wants to. It's about who's being teed up as a successor to the Trump crown. And Vance is doing a good job of putting himself in that position.
But this could destroy the Republican Party. This bill, I mean, utterly destroy them.
Yep. But the Democrats as a fighting force don't exist, do they?
Well, unless they're just keeping stum.
I mean, this might be the... Like, we've been waiting for a smoking gun, and we thought we've had them. Once this kicks in, I don't know how Trump would be able to cover that up, you know, if the Medicaid changes are as swift as they will be. That might be the breaking point for pushback.
And maybe they are just a disaster area, but maybe, again, let's play devil's advocate here. If I want to be a Democrat, you wait for things to plumb rock bottom. You wait for this bill to go through. You wait for cuts and price rises to come in. And then you launch your guy or your gal. You don't launch it. It'll be a guy, by the way, won't it? They're not going to take on Trump with a female again, unfortunately, but I think they've come unstuck with that. And you launch them at that point, because if you think if we had the leader of a kind of titular leader of the Democrat Party now, he'd just be coming under constant fire and blame from Trump, who'd be saying that all of this was the Democrats' fault.
There's no Pelosi anymore.
No, but there might be in the waiting in the. You know, the side of the stage, ready to come on. But why would you hitch yourself? I think this is the thing with this big, beautiful bill. And if it's going to be, which it seems like it is, if it passes as bad for normal Americans as it might be, then wait until they feel that pain before you launch your panacea. You know, don't do it in the middle of there, because that just would allow Trump to link the pain that's coming to the administration that was. And people will buy that.
Interesting that Kamala Harris said something on this on Twitter. She hasn't really said much since she lost the election. She's pushed back against it. Elizabeth Warren has pushed back against it. So maybe now is the time of the Democrats. I mean, how far out are we from the midterms?
Not actually that far. I mean, a year and a couple of months.
So when does the campaigning normally start for those?
Soon, yeah.
And they'll be deciding primaries pretty soon, I imagine. And
yeah, they'll be going hard after this. I mean, this is like campaign fodder.
Yeah. But that's exactly the point, Bridges, isn't it? You get Harris, Obama, Clinton. You get your has-beens to speak out about it now, and you keep your shiny person wrapped in cotton wool, because the muck spreader. Right. That is Trump is going to be in full force, right? Those muck spreaders that drive down the roads in Dorset, flumming pig poo everywhere. So you don't want your new shiny person covered in pig poo.
Yeah. You want to let your big guns sort of
you let your carry big the guns absorb it, because they've got big raincoats, right? And their raincoat is they don't really care anymore.
You need a Bush to defect. I think you need a big Republican to defect, and it happened even up to the election. We were seeing household name Republicans saying that this guy would be a disaster.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, that actually held minimal weight. What do they call it? Traitors, I'm assuming is what they would call a Mitt Romney or a...
But I'm sort of minded of that, you know, again, we're talking to A3 sort of global about this, to the, I always remember this sort of US Marines colonel, I think he was, at the siege of Fallujah, who was complaining that the insurgents wouldn't come out and fight it out like men. Right. How long would the Democrats last if they came and fought it out like men right now? Wait until it gets worse. Wait until all the blame falls very squarely on one set of shoulders.
Yeah, and they can't do much. I mean, they can't do anything in the House
now.
You can't do anything. It's unfortunate. They couldn't do anything in the Senate. It's proof from filibustering, which is essentially, for anyone listening, it's to speak as long as you would like on the Senate or House floor. I think it might be an exclusively Senate rule, but the House or the Rules Committee didn't allow that. So you couldn't, like Cory Booker did a couple of months ago, just speak extemporaneously. Where were we? I feel like we talk about U.S. politics too much. How about more of welfare?
I think it's sort of the relationship between the two houses is really important, because in the UK, the upper house, I think, has much more power than people give it credit for.
Yeah.
There's the significant reputational weight that comes with the people that are in the House of Lords, and the House of Lords in the UK is more numerous than the House of Commons. About 850 members of the House of Lords, it's always roughly between 775 and 850 in the House of Lords, and there's 650 in the House of Commons. And generally speaking, in the House of Lords, the government never has a majority, and that's been the case since 1997 when Labour got rid of the hereditary peers. And since that point, governments don't have majorities in the House of Lords. They might have a plurality. The Conservatives tend to have a plurality in the House of Lords, but there's not ever a majority there, which means that if you want a piece of legislation to get through the House of Lords without it being blocked for that year period that they can block it for, which is governments don't want their legislation to be slowed down by a year, you have to be able to recognise compromise and accept compromise and accept that when the Lords make an amendment to the bill, that you're probably going to have to accept that amendment to the bill. You might make an amendment to the amendment, but you don't throw the amendment out completely. It generally means that most legislation that's come from the House of Commons that goes through to the House of Lords, when it goes back to the Commons, is very different. And the difference has largely been accepted by the Commons when it goes back to the House of Lords. So ping pong in the UK can last for a very long time, as we saw with the hunting bill and some of the Brexit stuff, but often it doesn't, because the Lords accepts the primacy of the Commons, but the Commons also accepts the reputational weight of the Lords, and therefore somewhere they compromise on the legislation. And often it's described as a compost bin, the House of Lords. The Commons give it a load of rubbish, the Lords sit on it for a while, they make it better, it goes back to the Commons. The Commons is enriched by the Lords, and they accept that those amendments, it goes back to the Lords. They're happy that the Commons haven't said no. Then the King says fine. And that tends to work. And
it's the non-confrontational nature,
yeah,
I think, that does it. Well, I know this is taking this quote completely out of thing, but it was, I think they can be quite firm, but, you know, gentle. And I think it was, who's it said about Willie Whitelaw, that arguing with him was like being savaged by a wet sheep? Which is sort of similar. You know, these guys will be utterly intractable. And, you know, imagine if this welfare bill had gone unamended into the House of Lords. They would have kicked that around for ages, because loads of it wasn't in the manifesto. And, you know, this is another problem for Labour, is they did put other stuff in the manifesto that they haven't made good on. There was a thing about public candour that came out of the Hillsborough disaster, where Liverpool fans died, and basically they promised a law that would basically force the government to have public candour about the results of investigations. And Keir Starmer promised it by the anniversary of the disaster, which was about 3 months ago, and that hasn't happened. And yet reforms about welfare that weren't in the manifesto, and we're coming full circle back to Britain now, aren't we? But in Britain, we see the consequences of Labour following what people called the Ming Vase strategy in the election, that they weren't actually particularly detailed about anything because they're afraid of scaring the horses. But now you can't claim that you have authority or mandate behind that, because you've got the big majority, your own guys can still go against you from that point of view.
And that's the opposite situation in the States.
Yeah.
Trump was very, very clear what he was going to do if he got
into
power.
It's just people didn't believe him.
Yeah, but he said he was going to do it, and he's basically doing it. And the interesting thing about these two houses is that in the States, the Senate has significant power because they're elected. So they are on a level of the House of Representatives, and there's no distinction between the two houses. So it's interesting that this bill started in the Senate and goes back to the House of Representatives, because in the UK it happens in the opposite mostly. It starts in the House of Commons and ends up in the House of Lords, although things can start in the House of Lords. But what does it say about like the power in the United States between those two houses? And does this elected upper chamber have too much influence over legislation? And would you say that actually probably the Senate is the primary house in the United States and not the House of Representatives?
I mean, there's certain things that the House still, I think, has significant sway over, and anything related to revenue originates in the House. In the Senate, you have the notable inclusion of the president pro tempore, so the vice president presiding over the Senate and providing that final vote, which in this case, you just need to hit 50, as I said. If Murkowski had defected and that vice presidential clause was in there and something else being sent back down to the House, maybe with more restrictions, like, this would be a different story. The Senate, I think, with its confirmation power, with sort of the limited nature, obviously these are more heavy-hitting politicians, except for the likes of Tommy Tuberville, who was an American football coach and is now the most far-right politician in Washington. I think there's considerable sway, and then that trickles down to the House based on the leadership that exists in the Senate. But we've heard a lot from the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, who I think is a complete clown show. He's about all you hear from in the House. But the fact that it goes back to the House doesn't mean that they'll actually take any action against this, and it would, once again, be suicide for a Republican or more than three to defect.
I think, yeah, the more one reflects on it, really, and this is a history thing rather than necessarily a politics thing, about the foundation of the American Constitution is just a masterclass in be careful what you wish for. It's a masterclass in how trying to be really clever about something actually ends up, you know, sort of leading the whole thing to gridlock. You know, I don't think anybody, even their most fevered, cheese-driven dreams would... the founding fathers have conceived of a situation like this, or a president like this, or a set of circumstances like this. And I'm afraid their answers to the problems that America had in the 1780s has shown itself to be unequal to the challenges of the 21st century, where truth is not a thing and certainty is not a thing and people aren't just upstanding white men over 30 who own property. Is that too harsh of me, Smitty?
No. In Washington, it's funny you mentioned the problems in the 80s, because when we got out of the post-Treaty of Paris and the U.S. is in its infancy, Washington said he was mortified beyond expression at, you know, what had transpired between the Articles of Confederation, the lack of a central government, and the states taking too much power. And what he and Madison would think now is just, I don't know if they would have the words. It is a bit interesting to think about how Thomas Jefferson was so proud to be the president and founder of the University of Virginia. And if he could see Trump engaging himself in the politics of the university to forcibly remove its president, he would be aghast. And so that's a.
Do we think our constitution's holding up any better, though? Is our system of government holding up any better? And, you know, you get a government with a big majority and then it collapses effectively on one of the first strongest tests. What does that say about the strength of parliamentary democracy relative to presidential presidential system? You know, it's more like a challenge for liberal democracy.
Yes. I mean, I do think ours has held up slightly more robustly. I mean, it's seen off a couple of, I think, potentially could have developed into quite serious challenges earlier. I mean, I do think that given a different system, maybe this is just me being somebody who's not particularly keen on the guy, I think had he had the ability to do so, would Johnson have tried to become an authoritarian figure? I suspect he would. Yeah. But the system did not allow. Trust, the system has not allowed. We were talking back this time next year about, you know, Keir Starmer about to be the king of the world, and actually in foreign policy he's done well, but my lord, he's been brought down by the system that produced him. So I just think that sometimes by not having clearly defined systems, you empower the system. Oh, I don't know.
I think one of the big weaknesses of the US Constitution compared to ours is that role of the Supreme Court. And in theory, a Supreme Court that is a political court is, well, a Supreme Court that is empowered by Article 3 and says that the court can do this and this is the power of the court is great for the rule of law. But then when you start to politicise that court, to put the Supreme Court being politicised, that's actually has the potential to undermine the rule of law, not actually uphold it.
Yeah, that undermines everything, because ruling bills unconstitutional, not trying to allow the president more imperial power, which is what they've ruled on. And there were early glimpses where it seemed like they were sort of doing a U-turn on Trump. But now they keep digging themselves further and further into the MAGA camp. And once the Supreme Court falls, you do lose trust in the rule of law. There's no hope that the Senate or House will mount some sort of insurrection besides the Rand Pauls of the world. They still have enough to keep it intact, at least for now. And once they get the one big beautiful bill in, then all might go quiet for a while in Senate and House activity. It's this that Trump wants, is continuation of his 2017 tax cuts. And he's going to get more money at the border, and he's going to get more money for defense. And this is exactly what he wants. And to get it early, then he can just stay quiet for a while, or at least not have to worry about pushback.
I don't understand why he wants more money for defense.
I don't know.
I don't understand that. Why is a man that wants to end wars so keen on defense spending increasing so significantly?
He's a security dilemma. He's a security dilemma guy.
He's scared.
Yeah.
Scared of China, scared of the world, wants America to be a fortress America.
Yeah, but the problem is going to be, by doing that, is that you end up in the situation that China's in, right? Where you spend enormous amounts of money on a defence force which you increase steadily, but never ever get to implement what you're doing. China hasn't fought a war since 1979 against Vietnam, where they lost. Right, they've got this massive military. They spend loads. It distracts loads of public attention. They have massive military parades, but it's not actually much use for anything. And if you turn the U.S. military, which is a global interventionist force, into some kind of glorified dad's army, then what happens to that military power? I mean, the U.S. is nothing without military power projected overseas. We go back to what we were pre-World War II, where the US military was smaller than Venezuela's military pre-World War II, 160,000-odd. And literally all before World War I, exactly the same. Because, of course, the Constitution doesn't really empower for a federal army, because each state is supposed to look after itself with militia, hence the Second Amendment. Blah, blah, blah. It's all about home defence. All about home defence. Fine. Okay. So you are now going to become a second tier nation in the world. Okay. If that's his policy, if non-intervention is his policy, then after 80 years plus of building a global reach, you're going to be spending increasing amounts of money on what? I don't know. He can build four. He'll be like Enver Hoxha in Albania and just build bunkers everywhere, because so that everybody's like, paranoid about the fact that nobody's going to invade the USA. Okay? Deal with it. No, lots of people with guns, two weak neighbours. It's not going to happen. So, yeah, what's all this money going to go on if not submarines, B-2s? You don't need a B-2 if you're defending America.
You don't. Also,
the whole point is they're stealth, so they go to other people's countries and bomb the crap out of them, right?
There's no need for it to just be lurking in American airspace.
No, oh, we can't see it. Oh, our taxpayers' money are being so well spent. He's a moron. I know I'm never getting to the States.
The B-2s are incredible in that. What is it? They're radar signatures that have a pigeon.
Yeah.
That is nuts, isn't it? I mean, that is money well spent, to be fair, just from the technology perspective.
Yeah. When I heard they said,
if you're going over other people's territory, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So do they go? I heard conflicting things on a video. They went east
from Missouri.
Some went east, some went west.
But the decoys went to Guam and Diego Garcia because that would make more sense because they could just use this for staging.
And they were pinging this. They were pinging more of a radar signature because they had the air-to-air refuelers pinging with them. So you could see them tracking.
Well, the Iranians would have thought that they would stage from Diego Garcia instead of refueling.
I'm not convinced the Iranians knew what the hell was going on because I think their systems were so denigrated, but yeah.
So basically, the Israelis cleared up airspace.
Yes.
Where the B-2s could just... Yeah.
If the, Iranians did, get any information, it's probably through a signal chat from Hexeth, right? That hasn't come to light yet.
Yeah, but no one is at risk because the attack was successful.
Yeah, so, and he used all caps, so that's good.
The leak doesn't matter, actually. That blew over, didn't it?
It did, but that's the thing, isn't it?
It's funny, you look back and you're like, oh yeah. Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Your baseline shifted in what you're prepared to accept. Exactly. Shifts and, oh, that's happened, he's got away with it. Let it blow over, fine. And that was Dominic Cummings' strategy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He just, he just ranted against a Fox reporter for asking a perfectly normal question about the damage done to Fordo. But...
I think the problem, sorry, this links the two. This is British and American, and what comes around would be interesting, though, is Dominic Cummings' theory in the end failed, which is why I think the Conservatives are so weak now. That, you know, there are... You know, you've got to have trust and you've got to have performance in politics. And while you're in power and you're pushing ahead, you can spin whatever line you want. But once the wheels start to come off, that's when things like Signalgate come out again. That's when some of Boris Johnson's, former mishaps come out. And that's what destroys your party reputation. Yeah, you know, that's why nobody takes the Conservatives seriously at the moment. Now, again, the sad thing for the Republicans, not that I, feel much sympathy for them, is that Trump will drop them like a hot potato and walk away as soon as he can. The other entertaining thing we haven't discussed about the Big Beautiful Bill and other things is that apparently Elon Musk is going to fund people who fight the Big Beautiful
Bill.
Oh, and Trump's going to cut the subsidies to his...
And maybe deport him.
SpaceX, Tesla.
What's going on here? This latest little Barney between two lovers scorned. What's
for context and the fallout over this bill is related to Musk's original mission within Trump's cabinet, even though he wasn't a member of an official department, to cut government waste to avoid a bill that would add $3 trillion to the national deficit, which is already incredibly high, so that we don't default for the second time in the country's history, the first being in the 1780s. And now it's been a bit quiet because Musk sort of rolled back his remarks when they had a row over social
media. I could
escalate
this, but I don't want to right now.
We had the Epstein files dropped, and now we have... a bit more with the reality of the One Big Beautiful Bill coming into view. So subsidies are at risk for Musk, but then he's also saying that, what is this? He's mobilizing, he'll pay people to
fight. He's paying for candidates. He's going to fund Massey's campaign in the midterms. I think it's extraordinary in that veiled threat to deport Musk and cancel all of his subsidies is
at which case NASA collapses in a heap.
Yeah, but Trump Musk's also a citizen, so you can't just deport a citizen. He's not someone with a green card. He's an American.
Imagine the
your birthright citizen. I know. It's Trump's own children who are birthright citizens, isn't it? Because his first wife was undocumented. Okay, yeah.
Imagine the impeachment is centered around his deportation of Elon Musk. Imagine that saga. If that's the straw.
Here's the thing. What I'm going to try and do, and maybe I'll set it in my calendar now. What are we, 2nd of July? We're nearly independent. Maybe we'll do this on Independence Day next year. Next year, I am going to set up a kind of Teams politics teachers question time with these two ne'er-do-wells. Okay? And what we need to do is... And then we'll broadcast. I don't know how to work... If I can learn how to work the call-in in the next year... otherwise, we'll just have a sort of Teams thing, record it, and go for there. Smitty, where are we going to be 4th of July 2026? Let's go US, Europe, Middle East, Ukraine,
question,
Russia?
Oh.
US.
US domestic or foreign policy front?
Both.
OBBB passes. Around this time, the conversation is surrounding the effects of OBBB with midterms on the horizon. Democrats have found a leader who emerges by then. And on the foreign policy front,
Trump's still president?
Trump is still president a year from now. Russia, Ukraine not resolved. Gaza, Israel ceasefire, this 60-day ceasefire broken long ago. Conflict still raging. And I think Iran will be quiet. But Israel, Gaza, and Russia and Ukraine will still be the
China?
I think China will still be quiet.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Alright, that's all I got.
Bridges, what you got?
Trump in power, Musk still in the United States, not much change except the continuation of the status quo, but with the view that the midterms would be coming up and then they were only really 2 and a bit years out from the next election, I think you agree with Smithy that you started to see a number of Democrats starting to put their hands up that really do challenge Trump and MAGA. And I think that if there's someone that's young and charismatic and centre-right within the Democratic Party that can really take on Vance, then I think that'd be a really... I think that's the way that they need to go in it. I don't think they need to go down the route of someone of the mould of the next mayor of New York, because I think that just polarises things so significantly that the only victory from that is a Republican one. So that would be my view. I think I agree on Ukraine and Russia. I don't think much change on that. I do think Europe much stronger in a year's time. A year of that defence spending increasing is going to be significant. I think that Israel and Gaza will roll on, but I do also agree that Israel and Iran will be quite quiet. And I think the biggest shift probably is going to be in the UK, because I think there's going to be something fundamentally different about the Labour Party, and whether that's a completely new cabinet, whether that's something to do with the Prime Minister, I don't know. But I can't see this status quo continuing in the UK. So I think it's not America or Ukraine or the Middle East where there's going to be the biggest change. I think it will be within the UK, and I think that's going to be, I think it's going to be a big shift in direction from the government. What about you?
I'm going to go bold because you guys have gone conservative. And I know this means it won't come about. Trump steps down for health reasons. Vance president, with his party collapsing after one big beautiful bill before the midterms, he'll have to try and choose some more moderate person to come in as VP. I don't think that'll happen, but you know, if it did, it'd be good fun, wouldn't it? I can see things changing quite fundamentally with Ukraine, Russia at the end of this summer, militarily. The indications I see are that there are big offensives planned. They've already started. They don't seem to be working out particularly well. So I can see a scenario where Putin is not in control next year. And if he's not in control, he'll be dead. But I can see that. Again, I don't think that will happen, but I think there's a distinct possibility there. I think China quiet because, you know, they are busy building their reputation at the moment as being the centre of global stability from an economic point of view. So they will be making absolute hay out of Trump tariffs and presenting themselves to the global South as the people you can rely on. This is a massive own goal for the Americans, but hey ho, you know, you get what you vote for. Britain, yes, I agree. I think we'll see a fundamental change within the Labour Party. I think we'll see by next year, a new leader of the Conservative Party. Whether that'll do any good, I don't know. If it's Jem Rick, I think that's probably curtains for them, because he'll be absorbed by reform, or he'll, you know, sort of take reform cuckoo-like into the nest and get destroyed from the inside. But I don't see much of a political earthquake. I think the big news Britain-wise is going to be the dynamics within the Labour Party rather than what happens in the others. Israel-Gaza. I've been hoping for a sort of solution of the Israel-Palestine thing for pretty much all of my adult life. I don't think that's going to move on. Whether Netanyahu will still be in control of Israel.
War to keep going.
He needs war. Yeah. And if Trump's going to play hardball with him about stopping the war, then that could be him done. What comes after that, Lord only knows. But yeah, it's not particularly hopeful. Oh, the other thing, I do think that actually the signs I see that I think, despite some people's attack on them, I think renewable and green technologies are going to increase massively over the next year, particularly with the tariffs and the problems in the Middle East, in that people just simply for economic reasons are going to say, we cannot rely on petrochemicals and fossil fuels anymore.
Agreed. Keep the fires going next year, Mr. Vincent? PTQT?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we'll keep the fires going.
Who's on the team?
I don't know.
ETC, stepping up.
We'll have to see.
We've
got to
build a team.
We need at least one American. We could have two.
There's two.
We have options, yeah.
Well, there's three, but two who might want to come in here and talk stuff on that. So, yeah, we'll do that. Guys, thank you very much for the last. Bridge has been 9 years. Smitty, it's been a year, but it feels like about 10. I mean that in a good way.
You're part of the furniture now,
You're part of the furniture. So, well done. Do you want to sign off, both?
Just been a pleasure. This has been a ride, but it's been a hell of a ride, and it's a very special place, and everyone that carries on working here and going to school here has to stop sometimes and appreciate how special a school it is, because there's very, very few places that exist like this on planet Earth. So the community, the collective endeavor, everything about this place is really special, and it's sometimes people take it for granted, and they gotta just take a little step out and look in the real world and realize how unlike the real world in a really good way this school isn't. And I think that's really important. Just appreciate what you've got here, because it is incredible.
Yeah. Cheers, Bridges.
Yeah. Ready? I think wasn't really thinking about leaving like before this week, and then it sort of hit me on Monday. And especially with all the BriFest stuff going on, it's just another reminder of how amazing this place is and how talented our peoples are. And being here in the summer, I think, is a great way to round it out. And you get to see Bryanston in full form. It's really hard to describe the experience other than just being life-changing, and especially to be away from this political nonsense and be able to talk in a studio with you two every week about what's going on in my home country. I've learned so much from you two from a department standpoint, but as well just being able to get to know you all better. And I told Bridges I was intimidated by him in the beginning of the year, and finally broke the shell. So really have nothing to say but thanks and appreciation for this place. I'm going to miss it a ton. We'll have the recorded shows, and I'll try to tune in to your show at least live.
We'll do at least a couple,
I'm excited to see where it goes.
Let's hope that, like a sort of modern day COVID virus, you can infect the USA with decency and thoughtfulness and moderation. You need to inject that virus in there and start converting people.
It's a novel concept.
Smithy for 2029. That's what I'm hearing. Put him in.
Oh, he's not going to be old enough.
Yeah,
I know. 35.
Right.
35. Right. Cheers, all. Have a great last week of term. Have a great holiday. I will see you in September. We'll hear from these characters at some point, I'm sure. But that's us for this year. We're going to play out with a bit of Duran Duran.
Adios. Cheers, all.